What is up, Geekscapists? This is Caitlin from Final Frontier, the podcast where we talk about the science behind science fiction. Today, I am joined by amazing engineer Kim Stedman. She works for JPL, and she is the systems engineer on Perseverance, or as we know it, the Mars rover. She got her Bachelor of Science and Master of Science in Aerospace Engineering from Georgia Tech, and she currently works at JPL. She's also worked on missions as Cassini-Huygens on to Saturn and at the Mars Science Laboratory. Hi, Kim.
Hi.
Woo! Woo! That was a mouthful of stuff. You've done so much. So just briefly, we talked a little bit in the preamble, but you were inspired by Star Trek. Is that what got you into wanting to be an engineer? And what did Scotty do to kind of influence that?
Well, yeah. So when I was a kid, I watched reruns of the original series, and that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to boldly go. I wanted to be an astronaut. But then, you know, my eyesight wasn't so good, and I really don't like turbulence. And back then, your eyesight had to be really, really great to become an astronaut. And so I thought, well, I'll be an engineer, an aerospace engineer, and I will design things that go into space, whether they take humans or they're robotic. And I got very lucky and got a job at JPL, and now I work on Mars rovers mostly.
That's really awesome. So I messed up earlier and I thought the Perseverance was Curiosity. Did you also work on Curiosity?
I did. I've worked on Curiosity. I've also worked on Opportunity.
Curiosity, so. Perseverance, and Opportunity, I feel like are the three, you know, components of the Federation.
Yeah, they really are. Yeah. You have to take advantage of every opportunity.
I know. The coolest part about talking to, because we've had Kevin, who you know, on the show.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I've been talking to Jessica and all those, you know, all the nerds. What's fun about, for me, about interviewing scientists as opposed to interviewing creatives is the level of inspiration that comes from science fiction upon what you do. Have you mm-hmm. seen in your work anything that was definitely like pulled from a science fiction idea and you're like, we could do that?
Well, I mean, a lot of people that work at places like JPL, I mean, they were into science fiction, either reading the books or watching TV shows and movies, or actually both. My friend calls science fiction the gateway drug into the STEM careers.
Oh, geez.
So, you know, we take inspiration where we can, but mostly it's just inspiration to get in there and do that. And also the inspiration that there's no problem that we can't solve. Because in operations, once our spacecraft are either in orbit around another planet or they're on another planet, we have problems that come up that we have to find a workaround, a solution for. And it's the inspiration from those shows that makes us think, well, surely we can solve this.
Yeah. And I feel like, keep going.
No, I was going to say, sometimes you just have to think outside the box.
Yeah. I know that you also, you like Star Wars as well, but do you feel like Star Trek is the more kind of like, how do we solve this problem of all of the science fiction shows that we have? Because we've got a lot of space exploration sci-fi happening right now with like The Expanse, with Orville, and, you know, all this other stuff. But
yeah, there's so much now that it's impossible for one person to keep up with it. But Star Wars to me is always like, I think Lucas even said himself, Star Wars is space fantasy. And I mean, I was sitting in that theater in 1977 when Star Wars hit the screens and I was amazed. We'd never seen anything like that before. It just changed everything. And since then, we've gotten so much Star Trek, and now Star Wars just seems to go on. And they've got some really great stuff out now, like The Mandalorian. And
love The Mandalorian.
So it's really, really good stuff. So it's very inspirational.
Yeah. And even with like I think Lucas was really inspired more so by engineering and like the hardware of things than the kind of like theoretical of things, because he designed cars as a kid. He loved stock car racing. So it's cool that even if it is space fantasy and not science fiction, it's kind of cool that we have a franchise that's more based off of like the nuts and bolts of everything. And it's kind of inspiring that go, 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 but it's not about how it goes, less so.
Yeah. And I think a lot of the genius of George Lucas was behind the camera. Mm-hmm. I mean, look at what they have on The Mandalorian, the volume. I mean, that that's what he wanted back when he made Star Trek or Star Wars. Sorry, that's horrible. But when he first made the first Star Wars in 77, that's in his brain what he saw, yeah. And he just couldn't make it.
Yeah, so, and I think he's been trying to go back and kind of fix everything, you know, as the technology gets better and better and better, you know. And I think Industrial Light and Magic, because it came out of Star Wars, they've had to figure out, like, retrofit how to make everything look good on screen. And there's a great documentary out on Disney Plus right now called Light and Magic. I love this stuff when they're like breaking down the camera and it's like you're seeing all the like nuts, you're seeing all like the for lack of a better term, engineering of, you know, how do you engineer space and how do you engineer all of these things that have never been seen before? And that's kind of like what you do on the real life.
It really is, because, you know, several times I interviewed people in that documentary where they're like, we need you to do this, go do it. And the person was like, well, I have no idea how to do that. That happens to us all the time.
Yeah.
And you have to be comfortable being uncomfortable. You have to be able to, where I work, they tell you, we need this problem solved. And when you first get that assignment, you have no idea how to do it, but you know the steps that you need to do. And so you just go off and you work it until you have a solution, just like they did.
Yeah. I think my favorite part of episode one was when we're trying to get the transporter to transport the liquid into Spock's eyes.
Oh, yeah.
And my favorite moment was like, this is Ortegas. Find a way to make it happen.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know how to do that. Well, you have to.
And poor Kyle's just like, okay.
Yep.
So. And they do it because, they, you know, television, but also, you know, real life.
Yeah, it is. And you need inspiration in real life. And if you can get it from something like that, it's like in the Apollo 13 movie, when they're like, we need to make this filter fit in where this filter goes, and this is what we have to do it with. And they throw everything out on the table that the Apollo 13 astronauts had on the, in space. And they just had to come up with a way to do that.
Yeah. God, that's nuts to me. The nuts and bolts of it.
Yep.
So we are on episode three of Strange New Worlds, which I'm obsessed with, as everybody on this show knows very well. And all of my friends who are very sick of me talking about it all the time.
Mine too.
But we are on episode three, which is called The Ghosts of Illyria, which I really like this episode because it is very number one centric and I like her. There will be spoilers, so turn back if you do not want spoilers. But the basic of the episode is the USS Enterprise encounters a contagion that ravages the ship. And one by one, the entire crew is incapacitated, except for number one, Una Chin Reilly, who must now confront a secret she's been hiding as she races to find a cure. So this episode kind of starts with a contagion episode, mm-hmm. which you know, we know from being hardcore TOS fans is super big in TOS universe.
Yeah, it shows up in all of them.
I know. But my one is, I think the one that I refer back to all the time is the Naked Time.
Oh yeah.
where Sulu with the sword and, you know, it's George Takei being amazing. Mm-hmm. But I remember that one, it was like the crew becomes infected. I believe that the water in the body became alcohol.
Yeah. Something like that.
But it all started with like one member, you know, touches something like one.
He took off his glove.
Oh, God. And they even kind of did that in this episode where he's kind of like looking and you mm-hmm. see the kind of specks coming through it. And I did a little bit of research, and the contagion episodes are so prevalent and they're reflective of like actual sea ships becoming like petri dishes for viruses, like back in, you know, ye mm-hmm. olden times when we had sails. And I really liked the incorporation of such a trope of Star Trek. But I feel like it was modernized because of the light. I don't know how, but do you feel like it was modernized and used in a different way? Because I feel like what Strange New Worlds is doing is taking especially the Strange New World tropes, even though Contagion shows up in all of the shows. But I feel like this felt more like a Contagion that we would see in TOS. Do you feel the same way?
Yeah, I do. And I also wondered if they did that because it spread by the light instead of like, you know, people sneezing or something, because we had just had the COVID thing here. And so I felt like I didn't want to make it look too much like COVID, because when the lockdown first happened here, I was rewatching Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
And I hit their contagion episode. I'm like, nope, can't watch it.
Too close.
Too topical. And then I hit another episode of theirs that was about race relations. And I was like, and that was, you know, very topical too. And it had been how many years since Deep Space Nine was on? That is what I think makes Star Trek fantastic, is they cover these human issues that we're always going to be hitting. And yeah.
And seeing it from the other side of like the optimism side, and also like, because you mentioned COVID and we had gone through this pandemic when Una goes on the ship's loudspeaker and says everyone is quarantined to their quarters except for the and it's like we were getting quarantined and we were getting work pods. Like if you're podded, you have to stay there. And it's like, it felt very much, you know, I work on film sets, as I told you earlier, and it felt like, you know, you're in zone A or in zone B or whatever. And that was where it kind of became real for me. But what was different about it, and I think why I got the kind of like, oh, this is kind of like COVID, but it was still like, this is enough of Star Trek and it's different enough that I'm not like trauma triggered.
Yeah, I'm really glad they did it that way, because I was really interested in the episode and couldn't figure out how this was being transmitted and why the transporter didn't catch it.
Oh my God. And it was like but it was the positive addiction aspect of it. Mm-hmm. That they were not, it wasn't like they were like comatose and dying. It was like they were addicted to light, but it was like what could kill them was like them bringing more light in and like them bringing more energy in, like freaking Hammer with the freaking thing.
I know. I was like, what is he doing? But he was so calm. Oh, it's like be here in just a few seconds.
I didn't catch it in the beginning when he was like in the like transporter room. I was like, is he trying to save the ship? Did he get the contagion? No, he did not.
Yeah, he was very, very calm.
Which is almost terrifying when the engineer is super calm.
Well, yeah. I think engineers have when things get really, everything's going on at once, there's a big problem, and it has to be solved pretty soon. It's almost like, in my brain at least, there's a switch that flips.
Oh.
Because usually I'm very excited, I'm very happy, because, well, I'm working on a rover that's on Mars. And so when I go into work to do my shifts for the uplink shifts, I'm like, ah, everybody, we're here, we're working on Mars. Oh, we're going to have a great day. I have a lot of energy. I have a lot of enthusiasm.
Right.
But then when things are going wrong and there's a really serious problem that we really have to do now, it just seems like something switches in my brain. And then suddenly I'm like, Hammer. I'm like, all right, this is what we need to do. You do this, you do that, and you do this, and come back, and then we'll make a decision.
And I know you probably can't talk about specific things, but like what types of problems do you encounter because you're working remote? Like you have to communicate with something that's not in front of you that you can't hands-on fix. So how do you kind of solve
right, that
those
is
problems?
Difficult. But so when we do uplink, we sort of spend like 6 to 10 hours, however long it's going to take, to come up with the list of commands and the sequences that are going to go up to the rover. And that's what she's going to do for the full next day of her little life on Mars. And
so
we call she's a she. So we call a day on Mars a sol. And so we plan a sol. So we plan one sol. And Friday we plan three sols. But so things can go wrong during our planning session because we need to be finished in time for those commands to go up to her. And she's going to wake up at a certain time on Mars. I think right now it's like about 11 a.m. Usually it's nominally it's 9:30 a.m. At 9:30 a.m. on Mars, she wakes up and we send her commands on what to do for the next day or a couple of days. And then she goes and does that. And so so we have two kinds of problems. We have problems in preparing those uplink products because you've all used a computer and you know that when you really need your computer to do something, sometimes it's like, no, I'm not letting you see your email. No, you can't get in this program. This isn't working. And so we hit those kind of problems. We have a suite of tools that we call a ground data system that we use to prepare and check all those sequences before they go up to the rover so that we make sure that she's going to do what we intended and that she won't come to harm. So we run into problems with our tools. And when we run into those problems in the tools, it's like, well, now we have to get someone to try and fix it or find a workaround. And so there's a lot of pressure there. And then we have problems that come from Mars. Like we've sent her commands, she's done them. Something has gone wrong. Not that long ago, we took a sample because she collect samples for return to Earth because she's the first step of sample collection. But there was FOD, what we call FOD, foreign object debris in the drill and in the bit carousel. And so after we take a sample and we do all this stuff, then we image all of our hardware to make sure it's okay. And there was now something that didn't come from the sample and shouldn't have come from the rover. And now suddenly it's there. And so we have to take the data that we get from Mars, figure out what's going on, come up with ways to either fix the problem or give us more information about the problem. So that's an anomaly response team is activated and they work that. And so that's the kind of problems that we hit.
Jeez, I can't. I want to, like, when I was a kid, I watched Star Trek and I never even thought, like, I don't know why I didn't even think I couldn't be a scientist, but like hearing what you guys go through and hearing like how much you problem solve, it's like, dang, like I can't even, you guys are the coolest. Like I remember, I grew up in LA. So I went to JPL and I saw like, I was probably like, when did I go? Like early 2000s, like 2001, 2002. So sorry. Hi. And so I was seeing the first kind of like, you know, the prototypes and to see Perseverance in person before it went up. It was very, very cool.
Yeah. That was really cool to watch the rover get built because she was completely built. You know, all the parts came in from all over. The arm was built someplace. The wheels came from another place. So all those parts came to JPL and that's where she was actually constructed. Dang. And it was very exciting. So when I would have really long days before we landed and I felt there were difficult days, I had a lot of meetings, we had to make a lot of decisions, people didn't always agree, and you're going through this and you've had a really rough day, I would just walk over to the overlook of the high bay and look down at the rover, and that's, you know, that would help me get through that day. And this is what I'm doing this for. I'm doing this for this rover who's going to go to Mars and make fantastic science and make incredible discoveries.
Is it easier to know that, you know, everybody wants, I think it's in creative decisions as well. Sometimes it's hard in creative to separate like, oh, they're dissing my idea or, oh, I have to fight for my, like egos get involved a little bit. Is it once you step back from it and you're like, I'm here for a movie or I'm here to do this particular part of this movie or this play or this fill in the blank, it's easier to kind of take that criticism and take that step back. Is it different or is it about the same when you're dealing with, you know, scientists and engineers trying to get to space in a Mars rover? Are those egos still present or is it always about the mission?
Well, hopefully everyone's all about the mission, but everybody, if you're a systems engineer, you want to, and you have an experience, you want to give your experience. And and what you learn very quickly is your idea or solution, you know, may or may not have been better. But all you can ask for is that the powers that be that are in charge, they listen to you and they take that into account when they make their decisions. Because I get to make some decisions and some decisions I don't get to make. And I just have faith in the people that make them, that they have gotten all the information they need to make the proper decision so that we have a rover that will continue to operate on Mars. And that we have some really good people on the mission.
How long is Perseverance expected to persevere? In perpetuity or...?
Well, not forever, but Opportunity lasted about 15 years and she was only supposed to last 90 days. But that was because we thought the dust would settle on her solar panels. And then if you get enough dust on your solar panels, we're seeing this with InSight right now. The InSight lander that's on Mars has got so much dust on her solar panels. She's not getting much power and her power is dwindling and the mission will probably come to an end. I forget when they announced what they announced, like in the next few months. But what happened with Spirit and Opportunity was that they got dust accumulation, but then these dust devils would go over the rover and kind of clean them. And so you would get these miraculous cleaning events is what we called them. So our rover, when I was on Opportunity, we took a selfie where we looked down and looked at all the top of the rover where the solar panels were, and it was completely covered in dust. And within a couple of months, we had a dust devil go over, and the next day, instead of getting like 400 and something watt hours out of the solar panels, we're getting over 850 watt hours out of the solar panels. And you just come in one day and you're like, woohoo, power falling from the sky.
Thanks, so, Mars.
Yeah, and we did not expect that. And that's why she lasted so long. And Opportunity, Curiosity, who has the same power source that Perseverance does, she just celebrated her 10th year on Mars.
Yeah.
So we're hoping that Perseverance can last at least that long.
That's awesome. Also, kind of reminds me of like this Illyria, this Illyrian outpost experiences a storm, which, you know, the ghosts save them from. So
Yeah.
it's
Who saw
like
that coming?
nobody. Maybe Spock, because he stayed calm while he was reading.
Yeah. Well, it's important because, well, what are you doing, Spock? You're wasting your time. I'm getting information. Yes,
I'm learning.
he's learning. He's arming himself with information that could save them.
Exactly. Like a true scientist. And Anson Mount, God love him, is just like, can you do it faster? It's just like,
Yeah. He's fantastic.
oh God, he's great. The other part of this episode, which is another aspect of your job that I want to talk about with you. This episode switched the last model, the narrative model from the Comet episode, where as opposed to the away mission is the kind of A story in the Comet episode, with being on the Comet and trying to get off, and the ship was supporting them as the B story. And this time it kind of switches, where the ship is the A story and, you know, the away mission is trying to get back the two people who are stuck. Yes, this is an outpost mission, and so there was an outpost already built, but there's obviously no one there, and there's obviously like they're trying to figure out kind of what happened. I guess I want to talk about away missions broader in terms of where we're at now in space exploration, and what is the approach to exploring a planet from, you know, your guys's perspective and what you do, and like how do we approach like going to Mars, basically, because we if the further out we go, if the further we go in space travel, we will probably use a similar model of like, how do we, you know, do we go there with a mission of like, we are going to colonize or going to explore, or what are we, how do we explore, how do we do away missions? Because this isn't an away mission.
Yeah, so well, at least with the Mars exploration, all our missions have built on what came before. What did the mission before mine? What did they learn? And what questions did they bring up? Because when Voyager went by Saturn, Voyager got all these lovely images of the moon Titan,
Yeah.
and they were just all these images of an orange blob because they couldn't see through, the cameras couldn't see through the methane in the atmosphere. And so then you had Cassini. And Cassini had a lot of science objectives, but one of them was to what is Titan? What's on the surface? What does the surface of Titan look like? Tell us more about Titan because this is a very interesting moon. And also Cassini took a probe that the European Space Agency built called the Huygens probe. And so we actually dropped a probe that went all the way to the surface of Titan. And so we learned from that, and we used what we learned from that to, design all of our Titan flybys and stuff. And so you're just always trying to increase your knowledge. And so once we start going out further,
Like Spock.
yes, exactly. So I would imagine that these away missions would start more like what you see in the Stargate TV show,
Okay.
right? So they go, well, they have their Stargate, they open the Stargate, and they send the little probe through
Small
on its
probe.
little wheels so that they know that it's safe for them. So I imagine in the future, hopefully, these crewed missions, before they landed somewhere, they would be able to send some kind of robot or probe down to tell them if is it really safe for me? What is really down there? Or you might have good enough instruments on the ship that they're in that you wouldn't need to send the probe. But I would always think it's a good idea to send an unmanned probe down to figure out is it really safe for a human to go down there.
Yeah, unlike what they do in episode 4, which I do want to touch on because we talked about it a little bit and over text. Because Memento Mori is my personal favorite episode. I love everything about it. But they definitely didn't do that when they're like, let's go into the brown dwarf and like play with lights. Let's like have a per and I'm like, wouldn't you be able to? I guess not because you're in a brown dwarf, be able to
Yeah,
control it
Star Trek
remotely.
has never been for sending robotic probes down. They've always just let's just beam down. We've got to this new planet. Let's beam down, see what's going on, and figure it out.
Let's just
And
scan it
so,
to see if we can breathe in the atmosphere and then we'll be good to go.
yeah. And occasionally, in the original series, they would have their helmets, and but mostly not. And I think that was probably just a budget decision. And but that's where we got the transporters, was they didn't have the money to show them landing every week on a new planet, so they just came up with the transporters.
Which is not a bad idea. It's not a bad
No, it's
call.
awesome. It's awesome. But But yeah, going into the brown dwarf and being that close to a black hole,
my God.
that was creative.
I was
And
creative, but also I'm just like yelling at the TV, like, but that's so dumb.
yeah, but I like
Why?
what Captain Pike said. It's the Enterprise. She can take it. And I'm like, yes, she can.
Yes, she can.
She can do it.
She can
And
persevere.
yeah, I also like the I guess the mentoring or the feedback that Captain Pike gave to La'an.
Oh
It
my
says,
God. Yeah.
and how she kept her same concerns about the Gorn and all that, but she immediately changed how she interacted with the rest of the crew and really inspired them. And I thought that I hope that when if I'm at work and I get some feedback like that I can change and modify my behavior that quickly, because that was just a great, example of
Yeah.
we've got for all of us to work together, we have to all believe that we can make it. And if I believe we can make it, then everybody around me will believe we can make it.
My favorite moment was when it's like, yeah, we need to go further into the brown dwarf. And Spock is just like, that is not what I suggested. Hold on. Like,
Yeah.
I did not say that. That is your call.
Yeah, I did not. That is not what I said. Yes.
Nope. Do you have someone, because we're talking about the La'an, Pike relationship, which does develop more. I love that they kept go that going throughout the series, and not they didn't like hammer it that it was or hammer it
Yeah, all right, but
in until it like already happened, which I also feel is a TOS trait. It's
Yeah,
like you look
this
back and you're like,
show
oh
is
yeah,
very
it's about
TOS, very.
And I'm trying to like figure out why. Like I'm trying to like I guess why I'm doing this not only to learn, but also to figure out like why I love TOS so much and why it's different from Next Generation. But I guess my next question to you is like, do you have or did you have a Hemmer or a Pike in your scientific development and engineering development?
Well, you always have to have someone that you feel is in your corner, and you need that person that says you can do it. And when I was in college, that was my grandmother. So I struggled in college. I wasn't one of those people who just went to college, didn't have to study and made A's. I really struggled. It was very difficult for me. And I also had to put myself through college, so I was working at the same time.
Damn.
And so at some points it really was overwhelming. I felt like I can't do this. Just can't do it. I'm just going to give up and I'm going to quit. And then whenever I would tell my grandmother that, she's like, "You can do it. You can absolutely do it. I went to college when I had a baby." So I'm like, "All right, well, if you can go to college with a baby that you're
If
having
you
to look
can do it
after,
with a baby, I can do it.
then I can do it because my
Fine,
God."
Grandma, just one up me, why don't you?
Yeah. So, but it was very motivational. And then, once I got to JPL, there was people that were my mentors and my inspiration. And so, yeah, all through my career, I've had mentors and people that inspired me. And you just look at some people and you're like, I thought I was good at this job, but look at them.
Yeah.
How do they know so much? And so it's always, keeps me learning. I love to learn. I constantly learn. I learn new jobs up at work, new roles, and just trying to make myself better. So
Nice. Do
that's
you
very
have
Star
a
Trek.
very Star Trek? Do you have a La'an or an Uhura?
Well, not exactly, but I
Ooh.
do have there is a lady who has now gone to Houston, and she's a flight director for Artemis now. Her name is,
Oh, nice.
yeah, Deanna Trujillo.
Ooh.
And she was younger than me, but I always thought, wow, she's got it. She knows all this stuff and she knows how to teach other people. And so I just always used her sort of as a mentor.
Yeah.
And so
I think an aspect of the Star Trek universe is the ability to teach and pass on,
yes.
as opposed to like other shows where it's like you stay in your lane and I stay in my lane, especially in this particular season of Strange New Worlds where you have a lot of them crossing, especially with the cadet program. You're seeing a lot of the crossover of like everyone knows everything and you're in Starfleet and you just got to figure out what you want to do.
Yeah, but the thing about Hemmer and Uhura was that his purpose was to fix things that are
It's
broken.
broken.
And when he said that to her, it wasn't just that he fixed engineering things. He had sort of felt like he had fixed her in a way
Yeah.
to help her accept, and be comfortable, you know, going out and doing things, even though she lost her family.
Yeah. By giving her one in a way.
Yes. Exactly.
Yeah. And it was like the family that she needed, because I'm sure like, cause her, she got into, what's interesting about your story about your grandmother is that that's Uhura's story in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, you know, after she lost her parents in that accident, it's like her grandmother was her greatest inspiration. But she didn't really know where she wanted to go. But I think Hemmer was the kind of like hard, you know, very direct.
Yes. Yeah. He said it like he saw it.
Yeah.
And he did not sugarcoat it.
And I think, you know, in xenolinguistics, you have to say it like you hear it. Like, you know, as much
but
as
the
you
cadet
can.
Rotation was such a brilliant idea.
Oh my God.
Because we got to see everything through Uhura's eyes.
Yeah. And you got to see the important parts of the ship, because we kind of, especially in TOS, because I don't think they were quite up on their sides except for warp drive, because Dune had just come out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
they kind of like avoid, they don't avoid as much on Discovery, I've noticed. They really dive into like, you know, this is how everything works. And, you know, they're more science and storytelling kind of pulling together, because they need that, as opposed to, they're almost like a procedural where it's like,
yeah.
Do you like Discovery? Speaking of,
I have watched the first two seasons of Discovery.
Yeah.
And then Strange New Worlds came out. And so I really prefer Strange New Worlds, because to me, it is a lot more like the original series.
Yeah.
And so I need to get back to Discovery, but I keep getting sidetracked by things.
Yeah. And then Lower Decks just came out, in case you need a laugh.
Yeah, I've heard that's really good. I have not seen that yet.
It's funny. And if you want to catch up, I recommend it, because apparently two of the leads are going to appear on Strange New Worlds season 2.
Oh, I had heard that. Yeah.
Which just wrapped filming. So it's coming, everybody.
Yeah, I think it wrapped right before Dragon Con.
Oh, thank God.
yeah, because then I could get my photo op with Anson Mount, and there was no plexiglass, which was, by the way, a total shock, because when I bought my photo op for him at Dragon Con, it said Anson Mount will use plexiglass. I'm like, okay, I don't blame him. I want him to be safe. I don't want to endanger him. And then I get in there and there's no plexiglass, and I just melted down.
That's awesome. Who was the really first? Because you went to Dragon Con. I did not. I'm very sad. Kevin texted me every day. He's just like, are you going to Dragon Con? I'm like, still, the answer's no.
Well, you should go next year, because it is really a lot of fun.
I want to go. Who was the coolest? Because you met Jess, who plays Nurse Chapel, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Ethan, who plays Spock, and Anson, who plays Pike. They're all interested in the science aspect of it, right? They're not just interested in, like, you know, give me the script and, you know, I'll do my 12 hours.
Well, yeah. And Anson, when he did a talk, he said that he was a lifelong Star Trek fan.
Yes.
And that he had a big moment when he sat in the chair for the first time.
I bet he did, because that is intense. And like, when you become the captain of Enterprise,
Enterprise,
as opposed to other ships, because mm-hmm. he was technically the captain of Discovery in season 2.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I feel like Enterprise has such a cultural significance. And I don't think that name has been used by any space organization in real life, just out of.
Oh,
like,
yeah. The test space shuttle was called Enterprise.
No way.
Yes.
I didn't know that.
And actually, I think, and so people are going to say, oh my gosh, how does she not know where it is? But I think it's at the Yudvar Hazy.
What?
And the museum out near Dulles Airport, that's run by the Air and Space Museum. I think the Enterprise is actually there. And so I'm showing my age. So yes, people, I'm old. So they had a flight test space shuttle that was just for, it didn't actually go into space, but they would drop it off and then mm-hmm. it would do a, you know, flight down. And so the original series actors actually went out to NASA for a ceremony to Enterprise. And they named it Enterprise because so many Star Trek people wrote NASA and said, you have to name it Enterprise. You have to name it Enterprise. So that's the only Enterprise that we've had so far.
That's pretty cool. All right. I will take that to the bank. That's my big learning moment for today. I guess my other question, since I still have you for a second or two, is in Memento Mori, and talk about it as much or as you can. I know this is getting into more spaceship stuff now. In Memento Mori, they have to switch a lot of their dials around because the second they go into the brown dwarf, they lose most of their, you know, in like they lose most of their scanning ability and they lose most of their communication ability. They basically become a submarine. And what did you see as like when you're going in through a brown dwarf and it's like the deeper you go, you start getting like a lot of like the creaking of a ship. Like it really did feel like a submarine was in space or a submarine going through water. Would a ship actually make those spaceship sounds because of the compression or I just want to know if you noticed anything of that episode as an engineer that's like, yes, that's right, or yo, that's cool, or you know.
Well, I thought it was all really cool because, I mean, you know, people always want to fly into, you know, Jupiter or Saturn, but the brown dwarf's the same way. It's a big gas giant, and as the further in you go, the more the atmospheric pressure increases, and so that's why they were doing all the creaking and stuff. And I imagine if you were on the spacecraft, you would definitely hear that. And as parts of the ship buckle, I would think definitely hear that. But sometimes they just add stuff because it's cool and it's nice suspense. And so usually when I'm watching something like Star Trek, I turn off that part of my brain that says that's wrong. And it only gets reactivated when they do something really, really, really horrible. And that doesn't usually come in the science fiction, but sometimes it does. I mean, like the Enterprise doesn't normally fly like a real spacecraft would. It flies like an airplane. I mean,
right.
It does all this weaving and that and stuff. And all the all of our spacecraft have thrusters that point in every direction. And we just fire the thrusters.
And so
for a spacecraft to go here, it just goes there. It doesn't need to turn. The only time we have to turn and point a certain thing in a certain direction is when we want to do science. And to get good science, this instrument, this on the spacecraft has to point that way. So then we turn so that instrument points that way. And so if you've ever watched Babylon 5,
yes.
Babylon 5, their spacecraft fly exactly like spacecraft are supposed to.
Okay.
And when I think it was the Minbari were being chased, I can't remember who it was. And anyway, somebody was being chased by another spacecraft and it just flipped over and was immediately guns up. And I'm like, oh, yes, that's how spacecraft fly. But because George Lucas, when he did the original Star Wars, what he gave to the his special effects people was footage of World War II dogfights. And so,
yes.
So everything in Star Wars flies like an airplane. And in Star Trek, it's pretty much the same, too. They don't fly like a normal spacecraft would fly. But I just let that go because I love seeing the Enterprise going to
light speed. Leaving it out.
And yes, it's amazing. It's fun. So
Ortegas won.
Yeah, so when Ortegas is flying, you know, trying to get to the front of get in front of that comet, Ortegas, and she does. I'm with her. I'm there with her. I'm sweating bullets with her. But it's not what a spacecraft flies like. So
yeah, is a more accurate? I guess not, because I was gonna say like those little like you know pods that they take, those little like individual like crafts.
Yeah,
that fly more like the spaceship. No, they don't fly like they're still planes.
Yeah, they don't really do that in Star Trek or Star Wars. Babylon 5, I think, is one of the few places. And now I haven't seen a lot of the new stuff that's out. I haven't seen The Expanse and several other things. I know I'm behind, woefully behind.
I'm behind, too. I will never, ever catch up at this point.
But Babylon 5 has been the only one that I've seen get it correct.
Yeah. But I'm excited that, you know, we're getting... I think people are correct me if you think I'm wrong, but like, I think people are hunting for stories that are more optimistic, especially after the time that we just went through. And I feel like science fiction and, you know, the fear of the unknown, but the excitement of the unknown is more, you know, I what's funny is that before 2020, all of these post-apocalyptic stories were greenlit because they're like Westerns. They're like, okay, let's get out of superheroes and back into Westerns, but people don't like Westerns. So what do we like? Post-apocalyptic. And then we went through the apocalypse. So I'm wondering if there's an uptick in optimistic space.
I hope so, because I mean, the positive future that you see in Star Trek is amazing.
Do you
think everybody working together?
Yeah.
It's just wonderful.
Do you think that more people with this new Star Trek content will be driven into robotics and engineering and space exploration as a field and as a STEM field?
Oh, yes. Yes, I do. I do. I think all the science fiction that's out there, all the written and filmed, that's what it does. I mean, it doesn't do it to everybody, but it certainly, you get that interest in wanting to know more about the science or the engineering. And even for people who go into different careers, I think a lot of people that grew up on watching Star Trek and things like that, they keep that with them. And that's why I can go to a place like Dragon Con and go to the space track and do a talk, and I'll have 200 people come to my talk, you know, when they could go down the hallway and see someone else, but they want to hear about the Perseverance rover because they're really interested in that. And and science fiction conventions are amazing. There's so many really smart people there, and they really stay up on what NASA is doing.
Yeah, some people just make a podcast about it.
Okay. But that's wonderful. That's fantastic.
I love this podcast. It's one of the most fun things I've ever done. And it's what's the best part about it, and we're going to wrap up in a second, but the best part about it is how many new people from not my industry I get to meet. Like, I get to talk to you, and I get to talk to Kevin, and I get to talk to Jessica, and like all of these people who I normally wouldn't interact with or have a common bond with. And it's like science fiction, and that especially Star Trek, kind of solidifies that everyone has a bond. Everyone has a connecting point. You just have to find it. And so I'm really grateful that you spent your afternoon with me. I'm really grateful.
I appreciate
to,
it. I love doing things like this.
I love this stuff. So I just had a blast talking to you and learning about, I feel like I talked to like a Hemmer and a Scott. I'm not an engineer. like I got like a red shirt. Yeah.
Well, I can only hope that I can live up to their example.
We all do. I mean, you know, Scotty and Hemmer, and you know, for people who watched the show, you know, Hemmer is quite an example, and I hope you don't live up to that.
No, but I do try to live up to Scotty, and I did learn from him that if somebody wants something from me, I double my how long I think it's going to take.
That's smart. So. I actually didn't think about that, and I should do that in my life too.
Oh yeah. How long is that going to take you? 2 weeks.
2 weeks.
You got it done in a week. It's a miracle, Kim. No, it's not. So
I should do that. I should. I think more. I'm not going to. You heard it here, folks. I am not doing that. Thank you so much for spending your afternoon with me, Kim. And are you still on Perseverance? Is there anything in your future that you can tell us about, or is it you're persevering on Perseverance?
I'm right now persevering on Perseverance, and I'm hopefully will learn some new roles, you know, to do. And hopefully Perseverance will keep going, and we'll just have a wonderful time working this with the scientists and making fantastic science for everybody to read about.
Woohoo! And make movies about and make TV shows about.
Absolutely.
And if listeners want to know more about the Mars Rover project or Mars Perseverance, go to the NASA.gov website and JPL. They have a ton of information, and it's all very interesting. And I highly recommend reading up on some of the work that Kim is doing, because it's really, really cool in real life and not just in fake life. Thank you so much. I'm going to sign off. Final Frontier, Episode 3, In the Bag.
You're listening to the Geekscape Network.